Frank Prattle.
This is like when the other person's talking, then you're like, like making kind of weird sounds.
That's good.
It's really awkward.
All right, shall we?
Yeah.
Okay. Cool.
My name is Zephyr Thrull. You're listening to Frank Prattle. You're probably listening at artonair.org or at frankprattle.com. Today, we're here at the Chelsea Piers, right down on the water, looking at lovely New Jersey, home of the stars, and I'm with a star herself, Dana Schutz.
Hello, thanks. It's good to be here.
So tell us a little bit about what the hell you're doing here on the piers today.
Well, we're out here on the Chelsea Piers, and we thought it would be a good place to do the interview because it's scenic and it's really pretty.
And you have a new show up right now at Zach Foyer Gallery, just a couple blocks away. And it looks pretty different, I have to say, than other shows that you've had. Tell us a little bit about your new direction.
Yeah, you know, it is different. I started the paintings differently than I had in the past. A lot of these paintings start with a stain, on raw canvas with acrylic paint that's sort of watered down. And then there's a kind of acrylic polymer that goes on top, and then oil paint on top of that. But I was interested in having the paintings feel kind of more airy and washy and almost like a watercolor. And so that was really new for me, because usually I start a painting and it starts with an underpainting and it kind of gets really oily really fast.
And I mean, one of the things that you're kind of known for in painting is definitely a thicker, kind of chunkier impasto of paint in many cases. And it seems that you've kind of moved away from that somewhat.
Yeah, I mean, I think with these paintings, there's actually in some of them a lot less, like almost no paint in parts. I mean, paint that's sort of like a more ground into the canvas.
There's no paint in parts. You cut some parts of out of paintings.
Yeah. I mean, there's some parts that are actually gone. But well, there's one painting of a girl playing the guitar, and I was interested in this kind of interruption in the image, but also something that could kind of have a physical effect, both float in front of the image, but also do something to the image. So the place where the holes are cut out or kind of turns the painting into an object, like a guitar, but also it's in this intense part where it would be kind of painful for a hole to be cut out on your body, kind of where your heart would be, or like where place where you would lose your breath if you were punched in the stomach.
So it's her heart, her eye, and her kind of a knuckle there.
Yeah. But I felt like it kind of made the painting sway, like the subject feel like she was swaying back and forth.
All right. I really like it because from across the room, it just looks like black, that you painted a big black, you know, some black circles on it. But when you get closer, you see that it's really like richly black, and you have to get right up to it to see that you actually cut it out. Yeah. It just looks like very like the most intense darkness that you can get with paint, and then you find out it's not paint at all.
Yeah, it's velvet behind there, which is a kind of corny, totally corny material, and it has all these like kind of bad connotations. I think like magic, you know. I think the magicians use a lot of velvet, and it's meant to hide objects or offset objects, and I just wanted it to kind of offset itself, like a kind of absence. And I don't know. I think sometimes when people cut up paintings, it's kind of a either really structuralist thing or about the material of the painting. And I didn't want it to function in that way. I kind of wanted it to be just as fictional as the subject matter or painting itself. So that's why there was the velvet. I don't know. It was kind of tricky to get it to work or something. I don't know.
Well, it looks dynamite.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah. One of the other things that I noticed, just you know, going and seeing your show again, was that that you tend to have focused a lot on kind of group situations this time. You know, many times in the past with Frank and other paintings, it tends to be in the self-eaters. It tends to be a singular subject. You know, kind of engaging in some activity, and these tend to be more like, you know, large group activities, like signing a treaty or playing chess or an automobile accident or things like that.
Yeah, that was a different thing too. I think this show, it's, you know, there wasn't really a clear fiction. I couldn't really think of a fiction this time, but I think in the past there'd always been sort of narrative situations where that would kind of really efficiently tie in a maker and something that was made, or kind of played with ideas of what could be art or what's a kind of necessity. With these paintings, I was thinking about a group of make. Usually, when people make something, it's a solitary kind of activity, and I think there's something kind of both a little bit utopian but also slightly absurd about kind of group effort or kind of collaboration. I don't know why absurd. I don't know. Sometimes there's something, the sort of hopes of a group, which I think is an interesting subject.
But it kind of harkened back to an earlier painting of yours that I thought about was Fanatics, and that seemed to this show kind of seems to take that as a direction, like you know, like large groups of people kind of doing ambiguous, you know, or somewhat ambiguous things like massaging or something like that. And I mean, and I wonder, like, are you part of any groups or anything like that?
Not really. No, I'm not in a group. I'm trying to think. Am I in a... No, I'm totally not in a group.
Or like Facebook or...
Actually, I'm not on Facebook. And, you know, it's a weird... I was just thinking about this recently that, like, there's this kind of... I don't know. There's a lot of focus grouping going on now. And sometimes I wish I was on Facebook because I feel like there's, like, this underwater conversation that I just feel like I can't listen in on, or I'm not a part of. And so... I don't know. I've been kind of feeling frustrated. Like, maybe I should go on Facebook, but I feel like I'm really bad with email in general. So I think it would just be not good. But I was thinking about it. It's such a weird time. Like, we might be like the last generation that knows what it's like to live their lives in private, to not live their lives in public. And there's a kind of, I don't know, kind of interesting. I think it's kind of a fictional thing, like a kind of turning a public space into a fictional environment. Like, you can kind of control what you show of your life, or you know, if it didn't happen on Facebook, did it happen? Or I don't know. So far I'm not on Facebook though, but I have been interested in like that kind of I don't know how people try to define themselves with these, through these groups or through their interests. And I made a group of paintings that were kind of based on when people say they're into something, and it was just an internet search where there's all these things came up with that phrase, like which some were really strange, like I'm into armhole shaping, or I'm into I know, it's really weird. I was like, what was it? I'm into lemur racing was one. I'm into navy blue.
I'm into navy blue.
Yeah, I'm into...
That was mine.
I know. Who's not into navy blue? I know. But I was thinking about trying to make these paintings that could kind of be for a small audience or something like that. Like, what would be the painting for I'm into navy blue? Or, but kind of just as a framework to begin to imagine subject matter.
So when you talk about kind of like overarching themes or frameworks or kind of like, you know, underpinnings of projects and paintings and things like that, how often do you have an idea in mind before you start and then you kind of execute that versus like, you know, going out, winging it, seeing what happens and then tying it all up together at the end?
A lot of times when I start, before, like there'll be periods of time where I'm in a sort of downtime and I'm always kind of making lists in the studio, lists of ideas of things to paint or just writing down things that I'm interested in at the time. And sometimes I'll think I'll have an idea and then it just doesn't turn out that way, like when you're making the paintings. So I think it's a mix of both. Right now I feel like I kind of want to make paintings where maybe the subject matter is not as important or maybe deliberately not as important to sort of bring up the question of why paint that and then have it be more a question of how it's painted.
So as far as like, you know, creating worlds which to encounter work, we were talking earlier about your decision to kind of steer away from abstract paintings and more towards kind of like, you know, things with ideas in them, I would say, like specific ideas and figurative ideas, right?
Yeah.
Well, tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I love abstract painting. I think it's really, I don't know, I think there's something kind of freeing about it, that can be freeing about it when you look at an abstract painting, you don't know exactly what's happening, and it kind of, you end up having to sort your way through it by looking at it. And I mean, that happens with all paintings, I think. but personally, I feel like I tried making abstract paintings and I felt in some ways it started to feel almost like a performance. Like I felt like I was trying to think of how, just strategies or just ways to approach an abstract painting, and I kept on just wondering, like, where do I put the triangle? And it was like this really frustrating thing, and I don't know, but you know, I think in narrative terms. Not that the paintings are necessarily narrative or figurative or anything like that, but just that I think of information that it comes from the world, you know, like kind of in adjectives and adverbs and stuff.
One of the things that I was particularly interested in with your latest show is the singed people, or that I would say like kind of the half decomposed or vanishing or you know, what have you, half gone people. Tell me a little bit about them.
Well, that was for me a kind of abstract element in the painting. Like I wanted it to kind of do something abstract to the figures, like that they could become two-dimensional or kind of inanimate or not quite alive. So and it was interesting, just something happening outside of the painting that affected some parts of the painting and maybe not others. And I think for me it was like I started making those paintings and initially it was just sort of black paint, and then I felt like they could become within those sort of black spaces, that they could become their own, either more sculptural themselves or kind of more decorative and kind of flat. Maybe decorative's not the right word, but decorative just sounds bad.
I think it could become
totally
more arts and craftsy.
No, I love arts and crafts. No, but that it could be...
Why IKEA?
Yeah, I know. I'm really into design within reach, and I really like stripes. I want more stripes. No, I don't know. I wanted it to be, like, it could be something that could be very flat or, you know, more sculptural in the painting, depending on what worked within the picture. But some of those pictures are situations where something's about to happen, like they're about to sign a document or they're interrupted in while playing a game. So there kind of is no outcome for these situations. I felt like then without an outcome, the situations become almost just there for the picture. Like they're, the picture is like this space where the subjects can be rearranged in the picture. And then there's one painting of a group of people putting together a car and driver. And in some ways I thought, well, maybe all these pictures could be put together by a small group or something. I kind of like the idea of a small group because it's kind of has its own logic, and it's a really like, I don't know, I was just thinking about like cults or just where they can kind of make their own have their own worldview that's sort of not quite part of a larger worldview. It's sort of like a like if the people making the car, maybe they already had invented cars, but this group hasn't heard about it yet, or you know, or
right.
Or maybe there was a world where there was cars and then it blew up and now they have the parts, so how do they rearrange what they think a car could be, or you know.
Right. What, so when you talk about cults, what is your favorite cult then?
You know,
doesn't have to be favorite, but definitely, you know, top 10.
All-time favorite cult.
For the rest of your life.
Well, the Manson cult is interesting, just because it's so... no, sorry.
The king's name has been mentioned.
Oh, wow. No. Really, you know, that's really freaky. It's in the 60s, which is just such an exciting time. But I don't know, there's... What else? I'm trying to think of another... Well, there's that recent cult, which is really strange. Like the women and they, with the, you know, the sort of Oompa Loompa dress and the hairstyle, like
and the polygamy.
Yeah, which is actually a really sad situation, I think. But I don't know. But it is interesting that I don't know. Like there's something about the world that everyone feels like they. People are so connected and plugged into this world that there can be kind of one big conversation that's happening simultaneously and everybody's getting the memo on their Facebook. And I kind of like this idea of this group
splinter
faction.
Yeah, this group that's sort of on their own page and that's not getting the memo. And but they're maybe having their own kind of physical memos. I don't know. Their own designs or something, I don't know.
So, tell me how you get your information in the world. Do you are you a news watcher, a news listener, a book person, somebody who's stays fairly in tune, like we were just talking about with, like, you know, kind of separatists, you know, or are you somebody who stays fairly abreast of the latest?
Well, I like reading the news online. I get all my information online, I think. I'm getting the memo. But yeah, I read books. I'll go through like periods of time where I'll read more than others, because sometimes, like, you know, you can get really sucked into a book and then not, you know, do anything else. So it's been a while since I've read a good book. Or I mean, last summer I was reading a lot more.
What's the last best book you read?
God damn it.
Oh, I love that
book. It's so awesome, that one.
It's a George Burns, isn't it?
George, God damn it, by George Burns. It's a great read. The end is a little slow, but... Or the beginning slow. But... No. Yeah, I don't know. I'm trying to think of what was a really... Oh... It's really revealing when you ask someone to read, because I'm afraid that I'll say, like, oh, like, I read Kafka, and it's going to sound really, like, pretentious, but I was...
Kafka's awesome.
Kafka's so awesome, and that was a really... And I hadn't read Kafka before last summer, so that was really exciting.
Kafka's a classic for a reason.
He's amazing.
Yeah.
He's great. Yeah, and that was a great book.
No judgment here. I'm with you.
I hope it just didn't sound safe or something. Who doesn't like Kafka? But it's true. That was the last thing I read that I really liked.
Good, good.
Yeah.
So as far as, you know, plans for what you're working on now, things are totally going to hell in a handbasket, left, right, and center. in the world, and let alone the, you know, the crazy cult known as the art world.
Right.
Which I have a friend who he considers the art world to just be a large cult.
Yeah.
Or not even that large of a cult. You know what I mean?
It's weird that they call it, they call it the art world. Like when you look at the, you don't see the theater world or something. Or, it's a kind of definitely its own thing. Yeah. I felt it was really humbling because I was talking to someone who's really into skiing and they have like their own magazines and I started to feel like maybe art's no different from skiing, like the ski world.
Exactly.
Or dog world or something.
Exactly. There are probably more people who are into the dog world, magazines, than are into Art Form or Art in America or Freeze or whatever, magazine.
Yeah. But you know what, though? I heard this, and this was really exciting. I heard that more people, every day, the people who go to the Met, it's more than Shea Stadium.
Really?
Yeah. So it's like every day, it's like Shea Stadium.
Wow.
So, like, people are interested. People go to museums. Or people go to... I think people, when they go to a new place, sometimes think that they should check out the arts.
Is this after they ripped down Shea Stadium?
Yeah, actually, no. I think this is the latest figure. Shea Stadium. Yeah, it's that wandering... That guy wandering around with a brick in that area. That's just impressive. It's still where Shea Stadium was. Awesome.
Yeah. So, speaking of kind of the Shea Stadium and like Flushing, places that are farther out, where are some of your favorite places in New York City? Some of kind of your hiding places in the city?
I really love Washington Heights. I guess because that's where I kind of moved when I first moved here. So I kind of always loved that area. Like up by the Cloisters and stuff. But I hardly ever go up there because I'm in Gowanus, Brooklyn, and that's like a really far area to get up to. I mean, it's hard to get there. I'm trying to think of other... I don't know. I'm beginning to like Gowanus more. I didn't like it at first, but now it's sort of, it feels like it's getting better.
Do you know in the 70s, the Gowanus used to catch on fire?
Really? My God! I wonder what it is. I'm always living by places that have, like, the river is caught on fire. It's in Cleveland that caught on fire.
That's just a coincidence, huh, Dana?
I know. It's weird how everything catches on fire where I tend to live. Do you can't imagine?
So Gowanus is an amazing neighborhood, I think, because it's sandwiched really between kind of two, I would say, yuppie havens. Like, you got your Carroll Gardens that is, gorgeous neighborhood, but, inarguably filled with strollers.
It's totally a yuppie area.
Yeah, to the brim, right? And then right on the other side, you have,
Park Slope.
The very heart of it, the yuppie movement, that being Park Slope.
Yeah.
And then you got this crazy canal strip that is totally nasty and amazing.
Yeah, it is true. It's like, what did my friend who just moved here from Berlin, she said it was like the lavender... I think some tour book called it, like, the Lavender River or something. I don't know. I think because it's so polluted. It's, like, it's really, like, weird colors. And I saw a dog in the, like, floating. I guess there's a lot of stories about how you shouldn't touch it, Touch the... I heard that, like, children had gotten gonorrhea. And I think it's because they were, like, dipping... not their bodies, but like dipping sticks and stuff into the canal and playing with them and got gonorrhea, which is really sad. It's like terrible, but it's good. There's a lot of artists around there, and it's really industrial, so there's a lot of places where people can rent out and turn into studio space, and so I don't know, I like it. It's changing a lot recently, but
one of the questions that I've been meaning to ask you for a long time is, what are you listening to musically? What as far as music, are you drawing inspiration from right now?
Oh, that's a really good question. God, I've been listening to The Cramps in the studio recently. This is, like, really recently. I never really listened to them that much before, but I sort of got into them. been listening to Nina Simone. And there's this guy, Rick Berlin, who's really great and depressed. He's not depressed, but his voice is like so it's very barry. And
Leonard Cohen-y or?
No, not that kind of sophisticated. but he's great. Like it's really kind of soulful, awesome music. And then then there's like certain things that I always like to listen to that, like I kind of like listening to a lot of fast music. Like I like the Delta 5.
And so many of the paintings in the past, you know, you've kind of referenced musical bands such as, you know, the Breeders or ESG or things like that. And do you see that, you know, creeping back into your work that you're making now? Or is it just tends to be more subliminal, kind of, you know, laying the foundation for what comes next?
I think it's, it was always interesting to, you know, when you hear like old mixtapes of what you were listening to at a certain time and like how it can really, you think, oh yeah, I was making this type of thing, I was listening to this music, and sometimes it does kind of match, but I don't know, I right now I feel like I can't imagine, I'm not thinking about making any musicians, you know, but making paintings of any musicians, but I think it definitely does, like, I mean, that's what I listen to in the studio. I think it's so great when you get a new CD or find like a new band that is just really great, and you know, you feel like you could paint for hours listening to it and really keeps you going.
When I had an ex-girlfriend once who, you know, really drove home the point, she was depressive, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
and would and go through like episodes every, you know, month or two. She would like, you know, really get laid out by music or by, you know, whatever, by depression, not music. But she said one of the ways that she kind of like made sure to kind of steer clear of, you know, things that caused depression. And she said the number one for her was music, was like, you know, like the sad song or something like that.
Yeah.
And just the kind of the power that has, like she would often say, like music actually affects mood. You know what
right.
I mean? And I guess I never really thought of it that, you know, that's strong, you know, but would you say you agree with that?
Oh, totally. Yeah. I mean, I feel like there's certain things that I feel like I can't listen to very long in the studio because you just get really slow. Like I feel like when I paint, it can be not all the time, but it can be kind of really physical. So I feel like I like to move around a lot, and I think it's great if there's like music that can kind of match that. In the 90s, I listened to a lot of really depressing music. But I think that was just, like, indie rock, you know? I mean, that was just time just to be really depressed, you know? So I was really surprised to listen to that. It was all these people mumbling on my mixtape, and a lot of mumbling and strumming and people sad.
Meandering.
Meandering and sad.
Cat Power meanderings.
Oh, but Cat Power is so good, though. She's great. But
she's changed, though.
Yeah. She was great, I think, all the time. I even think that now, the most recent album, I really like that, you know. I like that song that she sings to Bob Dylan on that album. It's really great. It's such a weird, personal kind of song. It's kind of embarrassing and just really awesome.
What would you say the most embarrassing thing that you have ever done is?
Wow. Oh, no, that's something that's too embarrassing, so I can't really say.
Do it!
No, that's too embarrassing, I can't. But
was it
in art, though? In art? That's easier.
Across the board. In art, sure.
But
we'll get back to that other thing.
God, I can't think. I can't answer, because that's so embarrassing. I can't say that. And then
exactly.
This is a radio program.
Exactly.
I'm not going to. I can't do it. I'm not going to do it. Totally not going to do it. I can't. I don't know. There's certain paintings where I would feel more embarrassed of than others.
Is it just old paintings in general, or certain old paintings are you still very fond of?
Old paintings I can become more fond of. there was a painting in the last show where it was a woman giving birth, and that I felt kind of embarrassed about, because it was like, I mean, it was a woman giving birth, so it was like kind of really graphic and really, you know, kind of, it was sort of embarrassing. I mean, it was a big vagina, you know, so it was like kind of like embarrassing that, I don't know, so that was like, and not only that, it was like a big bloody vagina, so, so that was embarrassing. But I don't know, I think that's good, you know, like if it's, if you feel like kind of at like tender about what you're making, or I think that's a good thing, you know. Like I like embarrassment in art a lot.
I think that, you know, many times people say that that's how you know that you're actually pushing the envelope of your comfortability.
Yeah,
is the fact that you're, it's like you don't feel, you know, all, you know, you're not comfortable
so
with it.
Super comfortable, yeah, with it. Yeah,
that you're like, I don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
How often do you search for that kind of feeling when you're painting, that you're, you know, that you're actually reaching for kind of something new that might not look good, you know?
Oh, I think a lot. And it's weird because I think things change a lot too. So like even with color, like I remember a long time ago trying to make these paintings that were, like I was making these paintings of The Last Man on Earth from observation, and the palette really changed. And I think for me at that time, a lot of painting had a much more subdued palette, you know, kind of much more sensible or photographic kind of palette. Like things tended to be bleached out, but I just thought about trying to make these paintings that could just be really, like really saturated, you know. And I think at that time I felt like really embarrassed about that, like right away. It was always a thing, like, you know, like you hang up the paintings for the show and then you feel like I've made a huge mistake.
You're like, oh, shit.
Like, what did I do? Like, this was a really, but you know, I don't know. So that, I think at that time that was like a really embarrassing thing.
Who do you look at for your palette? Who inspires you palette-wise?
I look at a lot of different paintings.
Thomas Kinkade?
Yeah, he definitely.
Painter of light?
The painter of light. That's what they call him. But they, yeah, I don't know. I think I look at a lot of, sometimes a lot of post-impressionist paintings, I think. It changes. I'll take from anything. Like anything at all. There was a while where, and this is maybe not a good example, but I was like taking, this is like a year ago, I was just taking colors from like the malfunction on my printer, you know, because it had this like kind of weird purpley bleached out thing. And I kind of wanted, like, you know, in some late Picasso paintings, they have like this sort of purpley scrubby ground. And I kind of wanted it to feel cool like that, like temperature-wise cool. So I don't know. So a lot of those paintings have this kind of bleached purpley look or something. But it was just because my printer was out of ink, and at that point I wasn't looking at a lot of, like, taking painting colors from a lot of paintings, but I actually sometimes just take colors from paintings, so.
One of the things that I noticed, and tell me if I'm on the mark here, I could be totally, you know, sailing off in the middle of the channel on this one, but that some of your more recent paintings from this last show have a very, like, kind of outline quality to them that was reminiscent in a good way, I think, and I'm a fan of this yeah, painter, so, you know, many times when you mention this painter, people, you know, bristle immediately, right. But I like him, is Van Gogh.
Oh, yeah.
Van Gogh's, like, line for his drawing line, and also Enzer. Do you know?
Yeah. Oh, I love those painters a lot. I think they're great. I don't know what else to say other than
you're like,
they're great.
You're wrong.
No, but they're, I really, you know, I actually felt like some of these paintings had the kind of, I didn't really think about this till afterwards, but had this kind of glazed look, which I didn't know if that was a good thing or bad, like, you know, or it's kind of a weird thing kind of reminded me of like when Renoir, which Renoir is sort of horrible. So it's weird, you know, when you're like making the paintings, you're like, oh yeah, is that kind of Renoir-y? You know? But I wanted the paintings to kind of feel French, you know, specifically French, like from a, I don't know. I think I was looking at a lot of paintings that were made around the either the beginning of the 1900s or the late 1800s, and I just thought it was an interesting time because it was like they're making these paintings right before the world was about to change, and and there's these sort of smaller societies that maybe weren't in the city that could see that the world was changing, but they weren't there yet. You know, like they could see trains in the distance, but, you know, and see some of the effects, but it was still like they were farming and having a kind of local culture or something, and sort of interested in that. I don't know. I also just like the paintings from that time were kind of a weird space to imagine, like what, like, you know, there'd be paintings, like Mulderson Becker paintings, where there'd be just like ducks, you know, and people, and like people trying to entertain themselves in the midst of nothing or work. I don't know. It sounds really dull. But yeah, I don't know. It was just, I was thinking about that. But yeah, I don't know. I felt weird that, because I feel like this, the palette for this, a lot of these paintings are really happy. And that was something that I didn't like foresee. Which is odd, you know, like you can be in your studio and you don't realize that it seems so happy until you take it out. Sort of like going out into the daylight and then you realize, oh, I put this on. Like, yeah. This
green,
it's not
and yellow.
Spring yet. Like, what's the. I know, yeah, so that was, I felt kind of, I felt weird about that, I think. I think I started to feel like really weird at the opening, like, oh, God, they're really happy. I don't know how I feel about that, you know.
What? Many times in the past, you've painted really odd, kind of macabre scenes, I would say, that, you know, but handled with a light hand, I think. You know, you don't have, like, a blood dripping off, a stump or anything, you know, from somebody's, you know, dismembered leg or anything like that. But, you know, you do have a dismembered leg there, or somebody's, you know, teeth, like, gnawing their own face off, you know?
Yeah.
But this one, definitely, you have elements of it, but I'd say it's less than the past.
Yeah.
Do you think you're just happier now?
I don't think I'm. No, I did start jogging. So maybe. No, but I don't think I'm like happier than before. But I don't think I'm happier. I don't necessarily. It's not. Yeah, I don't know. I think I was just sort of thinking about, it's weird. Some of the paintings I kind of felt like that I gravitated more towards in this show were like the ones that were kind of subject matters that weren't supposed to be necessarily interesting, you know, like people playing chess, you know, and that.
Do you play chess?
No, I don't. And it's probably obvious from the painting because. Apparently that's not what a chessboard looks like, and like I don't, it's chess-ish or something. But I don't know. And then there is a kind of I guess I, you know, wanted the focus of the paintings to be more on the feeling of the paintings, or the sort of feeling of an image that could come together, rather than a really stark subject matter that. I don't know. I think 2 years ago I had a show, in 2007 at the gallery, and it was kind of, it was very, I felt like the subject matter was really bleak, you know, which I never really set out to paint that. But I think for that show, I was aware that, there was like a big plague painting, and it was like, and then there was like a lot of,
there's a lot of brown.
Yeah, in this show there was a lot of in that particular show there was a lot of subjects that were kind of bleak, and there was a lot of a very subdued palette, and I wanted the show to feel very atmospheric, and so I don't know, I feel like maybe, you know, I think sometimes you always kind of can go back and forth or something, so I didn't want it to feel maybe it's depressing. I don't know.
Yeah. What do you have planned for the future? Are you you gonna take a break?
No, I'm actually gonna keep on painting.
You're like, that was it. My last show. Did you like it?
That was it. I was happy. I'm teaching a lot, like this.
Where do you teach?
This month. Well, I'm going to do a mentor group thing at Columbia. I'm filling in for Amy Silman, so those are really, really big shoes to you know, try to. I hope they're not totally disappointed. and then sort of just some teaching jobs that are out. Kind of visiting artist jobs and stuff.
So what do you think then about kind of the I would say the MFA institution that has arisen in America? Because it is it's a very real entity now, yeah. You know, churning out thousands, you know, yeah. Thousands and thousands of kind of licensed artists per yeah. year, you yeah. know what I mean? What do you think about that?
I don't think it's necessary, but I had a really good, because I've known people who've gone, you know, haven't been to gotten an MFA and everything is fine and it's great. They're making interesting work, but personally, I had a really great experience there. When I went to Columbia for graduate school, and I think that was in 2002, and it was kind of right before it got this reputation as being like this kind of program that was really attached to the art market, and it really wasn't like that when I was there. And, we would have open studios and people wouldn't, I think it was maybe right before it was about to happen in that way. But I don't know, I think that it's easy to like confuse the, how something gets exploited with what actually happens in the program. And I think that there's a lot of serious people who are just interested in a good discussion and trying to make, you know, art that they find interesting and new. I actually didn't find it wasn't what people would assume, that people are just trying to make like product for the market. It was actually, people would be really suspicious of that and trying, you know, that was just not what you wanted to make. So I think people were trying to find a new space, I think. And I think that that's probably true of most groups who go through an MFA program. I liked it because it was interdisciplinary. I think that was good.
How much, you know, and this might be a bit of a personal question, yeah. but how much of your own success do you think was due to, you know, going to some place like Columbia MFA?
I think it was a big part of it. It made moving to New York very easy because I was coming from Cleveland, and it was a place where you can, you know, have a studio and also like a there was a really great group of people around in the program, so you immediately had this kind of discussion, and I thought that was that was really exciting. I think being in New York is exciting too. I just felt like so excited just to like move to New York City.
Are you still excited to be here?
Yeah, I want to move back into New York City, but it's—I don't know. Right now, we have a studio, a really great studio situation. Actually, like a lot of people who I knew from Columbia, like kind of renovated like a studio space in Gowanus. So that's really great. I mean, like the studio there is really, really like that. But I don't know. I can still find New York really romantic, and I want to be in New York. I still get excited about it.
Awesome.
New York. No, it's so great because people on the street, and like you're walking, and you can walk really fast, and you can be really anonymous, but at the same time, see so many people when you're walking. It's awesome. It's really great.
Going other places, and I know people talk about this all the time, but it amazes me, continuously amazes me, how much faster I have got at walking since living here.
Yeah.
Because you will go someplace, other cities, you know, like cities with, you know, millions of people in them, and you will be smoking people on the sidewalk.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And your friends will be like, Jesus Christ, slow
right.
down.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're like, what? I'm just walking.
I'm just walking. I know. Yeah. Yeah. It's like you, it's the best exercise. I saw pictures of myself from when I first moved here and from Ohio and I don't know.
Tell us.
No, I don't know. I was just saying, I was just, you know, I mean, it's just like, yeah, you, I guess it's so built into like, you know, like just you end up walking faster and I, you know, you go to another place and sometimes you get just irrationally upset that the coffee is taking forever. You're like, what the hell are you doing back there? Like, they're not like making the coffee, you know, like it just takes forever. In other places, you're just like, yeah, you can get really impatient really quick. But it's just because you're so used to... I remember that was the thrilling thing about first visiting New York is, like, you get a coffee and it was just, like, it was so fast, you know? Like
it was in a brown paper bag.
Yeah, it's just... Yeah, it was awesome. It's really good. Yeah.
So, one question that I have that is, you know, that we kind of hit on a little bit earlier is that, you know, the economy... Of the world, you know, many people just focus on America, but the whole fucking thing is going down.
Yeah.
Supposedly.
Yeah.
Many people say the sky is falling.
Could be like the end of capitalism as we know it.
Could very well be, which is, you know, troubling when you think about some... No, I was about to get political. Never mind. is that, you know, as far as the arts and things like that, you know, are being directed very, very, you know... are being affected very directly, rather.
Right.
I mean, your own gallery, Zach Foyer in Chelsea, he has just recently let go of, I believe, about 8 artists.
Yeah.
And other galleries are closing, like Guild and Grayskull, like Roebling Hall, Rivington Arms, other bunch of, you know, places that were actually, weren't just kind of like sideline galleries, but actually good galleries
yeah.
making cool things
yeah.
and representing good people.
Yeah.
You know, many people see it as troubling times.
Yeah.
What do you think about that? Has that affected you at all, or, you know, your friends or anything?
I mean, it's affected a lot of my friends. I mean, I think it's horrible, like how a lot of these places are really... I mean, Guild and Grayskull closed. I thought it was such a fantastic program, and it's going to be really missed, I think. And I have a lot of close friends who were showing at Zach's, and... I personally am going to really, I just miss showing with them. But like I just think it's, you know, at the same time though, it's weird. You start to feel a kind of strange, well, it's maybe it's not strange, but like an optimism at the same time. I think because whenever things are really in flux and you don't know what's going to happen, I think people get really excited. So I feel like it's that kind of time, you know, like people, although they, you know, had felt depressed about certain things closing, like there seems to be a real optimism about like making art, and I think that's really exciting. And I don't know, I just heard about this thing where people have like started like showing work in like apartments and like old. Like apart, like finding places on Craigslist and having these kinds of like one day shows in these empty apartments that they'd find, and I don't know. I think artists tend to find a way, and I think the positive thing about this is that it kind of makes it not like such a strange thing for artists to put on their own show. You know, it's kind of a almost like really accepted thing, you know. So I think that's a really exciting thing about it. But it does suck. I mean, because it's in some ways because you know some people, a lot of my friends kind of relied on they might sell a painting every now and then or you know, but they're like you know really interesting artists always working in the studio, and you know that would. But most of their jobs that they would take were kind of jobs that were related to the art world, like art handling or, you know, working as an assistant or, you know, jobs that somehow the art world makes possible, and those jobs are gone. So it kind of just makes it harder on a lot of fronts, you know. I had a friend who was looking for a job, and it took, like, you know, like before all this, like, it would take, you know, he'd get so many offers in a week or something, you know, like freelance jobs, and then maybe he'd get two in a month, like now. So it's, like, really shifted, really changed.
It's as far as, you know, assistants and people like that, you know, many painters nowadays, you know, they don't paint their own paintings. For years and years, you know, people haven't painted their own paintings. They've, you know, relied very heavily on assistants, or, you know, sometimes, you know, just outsourcing to China, and not assistants that you even know, but just, like, you know, people who know how to paint in China. You know, you send your photo to them, and it comes back as a, you know, 12-foot by 8-foot painting of something,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
For as far as yourself, what kind of role do assistants play in your own art?
I have a friend named Peter. No, I have a friend. I don't really have assistants, but I, sometimes, like, when things are, like, when I'm getting ready for a show or something, I, like, it really helps. Like, someone will clean brushes, and that's great because I have a lot of brushes.
How many do you think? Rough.
I don't know, like a lot.
200?
I can't have that many brushes. I don't think that many brushes. But I have a lot of brushes, and then they get really
like
messy.
Francis Bacon style?
Well, there's a lot. Some of them are, like, kind of useless, like, kind of grubby. Like, I don't really throw things away so much. So there's just a lot of brushes. So sometimes, like, someone will help clean brushes. And then, and that's really helpful. And that's it. I like painting the paintings myself. well, I mean, it just wouldn't... I don't know, just with my work, it just doesn't make sense to have an assistant in that way, you know? So that's all.
Good. Well, you know, as far as the future and things like that, you're going to be traveling this summer?
My husband and I might go to Portugal. He might be in the Portugal Biennial.
Hot damn.
Yeah, so I don't know. I hope maybe that's not in the summer, though. That might be in September, but I've never been to Portugal, and I really want to go to Spain, so I'm really excited about that.
Fantastic. Yeah. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, well, thank you. This is a lot of fun.
My name is Zephyr Thrall. You're listening to Frank Prattle at www.frankprattle.com or at Art International Radio at artonair.org. My special guest is Dana Schutz. We're here. It's practically boiling for this time of year.
It's really hot.
It's like 65.
We're wearing sweaters, too.
Sweater dorks on the pier.
Yes.
Take two.
V-neck sweaters. Yes.